armed forces is now open in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Our first case of the week is United States against Custis. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of this court. My name is Captain Tim Cox, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, represent Airman Custis, the appellant in this case. A case which asks whether or not a crime fraud and joint participant exception to the medical communications privilege should apply under the military rules of evidence. In this case, private conversations between Airman Custis and his wife were used against him at his court-martial. And while these conversations involved the planning and commission of a crime, it was error to admit these statements because Military Rules of Evidence 504 is the President's clear and specific guidance as to what is privileged and what is not between spouses. And the plain language of this rule does not include a crime, fraud, or joint participant exception.
Is there any case law that tells us that or tells us the reverse?
The case law that we rely on would be the judge.
Is it an exclusive list of exceptions?
There's nothing that suggests that it's an exclusive list, other than perhaps United States versus McCollum, which suggests that when private communications between a husband and wife meet the requirements of MRE 504, and if the privileges listed therein don't apply, then the privilege should apply, or the exceptions listed therein. If they don't apply, then the privilege should apply. Military Rules of Evidence 501 is a basis to claim a privilege rather than for a court to find an exception, and the common law to apply to a specific rule of privilege. And the error was not harmless, especially with respect to the solicitation charge. Now, first of all, when the President promulgated the Military Rules of Evidence, he set forth specific rules of privilege, the purpose for which was to establish stability in military justice. He wanted to make sure that everyone involved at all stages and all proceedings, cases, and actions in military justice, which includes lay people, knew what was privileged and what was not.
Can I go back to your answer over here? Are you saying, with respect to this list issue, the enumerations, that there's nothing that supports that argument?
The argument put forward would be statutory construction, expressio unius est exclusio alterius, where if the President sets forth the specific list of exceptions, then that which he doesn't state would be not included. So it would be, our position is yes, it is exhaustive.
Okay, so you were responding that in your view there is no case law that supported that position?
Other than perhaps Judge Everett's concurring opinion in United States versus Smith.
What about United States versus Tipton?
As well with Judge Everett's opinion there, where he said if they're going to list the exceptions, then it's captured in the rule itself. So I apologize. We would rely on Tipton and then also Everett's opinion in Smith. Now, one of the rules of privilege that the President set forth was the medical communications privilege. And generally speaking, that rule provides a privilege to prohibit the admission of conversations between husband and wife at a court martial. Now, the President didn't exclude all private communications. He did recognize, as we've talked about, three specific exceptions. And none of those exceptions include a crime, fraud, or joint participant exception. However, it's important to note that the concept of such an exception was not unknown to the President, because he did provide for such an exception in two other specific rules of privilege. Yet in 27 years since promulgating the rules, he has not added that exception to the marital communications privilege. So it is telling that his action, or better stated, his inaction regarding his list, it is exhaustive, and that is our position. So the plain language should control. And when the rule is clear and the language is clear within a rule, the court's function is to apply the terms according to its terms and enforce it according to its terms. The military judge in this case ironically seemed to recognize that, because before issuing his ruling, on page 34 of the record, he said, if I were to apply Rule 504, I would grant the defense's motion. But what he did instead was apply Military Rules of Evidence 501. That rule, however, the plain language in that rule suggests it's merely a basis for a service member to claim a privilege. The rule starts out by saying, no person may claim a privilege unless provided for or required by the Constitution, an Act of Congress, the manual, or failing that, then the rules of common law. The drafter's analysis even tells us that it is a basic rule of privilege. And again, the specific language in the drafter's analysis says that the rule recognizes privileges as provided for or required by the Constitution, an Act of Congress, the manual, and then the common law. So again, if we look at the plain language of that rule, it would seem to suggest that we do not apply a common law exception to an otherwise specific rule of privilege. Rather, what we do is you use that rule for a service member to claim a privilege. But by applying a common law exception, by turning to 501 and applying that to a specific rule of privilege, that would frustrate the President's purpose in listing a specific rules of privilege in the first place. There's no reason to have a specific rule if the common law can come in and trump it. So they are inconsistent if, as it's applied, as it was done in this case, in the sense of you have a specific rule, you have a common law rule, and if you bring in the common law rule, then you've rendered the President's specific rule meaningless.
Doesn't 501 also import the rules as used in the U.S. District Courts unless contravened by the MRE?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you've got 10 out of 12 or 11 out of 13 Article 3 circuits saying this exception exists.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Our position, though, would be that the courts develop, and the circuit courts develop that under their experience, their wisdom, and experience under the Federal Rule of Evidence 501. In military justice, the President has been entrusted to set forth the specific rules of privilege, and he has not adopted that exception to the privilege himself. We would suggest that that would be his responsibility to adopt that exception if he saw fit.
Is that the end of your argument? Are you arguing that, therefore, application of that exception is inconsistent with the rules as they presently stand, or are you just saying this is something the President should do?
We are arguing that it's inconsistent with the rules as they currently exist, because the rules that currently exist, 504, does not include that exception. While the common law does, applying the common law exception to MRE 504 would be inconsistent with what the President has already done. What applying the common law exception essentially would be bringing the common law rule of privilege for marital communication into military justice. But the President has already spoken.
Is there any reason why the President could not do that in your view? If you are correct that he has not done so, is there any reason why he could not do so?
In bringing in the exception?
Yes, expressly.
No,
there's no legal prohibition to applying it in the military.
No, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
That was my answer.
Well, what are we to make of the fact that there is a similar exception in other rules of evidence, but not in this one?
It's very important. The fact that it is included in other rules of evidence, but not included in this specific one, suggests the President's intent not to at least include it at this point in time. The plain language would control. While it does exist in other privileges, it doesn't exist in this privilege because the President has spoken.
Do you know if the crime fraud exception was recognized in any of the district courts at the time that the military rules of evidence were promulgated for the first time?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I didn't cite it in the brief. It does appear that some circuits at that time, at least in 1980, did recognize it in some shape or form. What I would submit is that by the mid-80s, it became abundantly more clear that the rest of the circuits were willing to adopt it.
And has the President made any other changes to the military rules of evidence since the mid-80s when this crime fraud exception became widely accepted?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that he has. I also know that 504 is currently under suggestion for change, but it does not include the crime fraud or exception. What we would also suggest is that the Army Court in United States versus Davis, as well as Stephen Salzberg in his military rules of evidence manual, which we cite in our brief, do recognize that 504 is a good candidate for revision. Until that time, however, we would submit that a court's function, a judge's duty, is to apply 504 as it exists.
Counsel, could you turn to that? If you're finished, could you please talk about why there's prejudice, even if there was error? Why we should find that there was prejudice, assuming error?
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the solicitation charge, the erroneous admission of this evidence was not harmless, and it's the government's burden to prove that it was harmless. The government's case on the solicitation charge consisted entirely of the wife's testimony. What the government sought to prove was that it was Airman Custis's idea, that it was his serious request that she commit the crime of obstruction of justice. Now, it was her testimony that provided the government with the evidence and its ability to argue that this was indeed the case. It was Airman Custis's wife who said that Airman Custis initiated the conversation, that he was the one that asked about the lab, about its procedures, that he specifically asked, how can this be fixed? She also testified that he expected her to do this and that she felt uncomfortable in doing so. So this evidence formed the government's basis to argue on page 595 of the record that in order to find Airman Custis guilty of solicitation, you have to find that it was his idea. No other evidence was presented for the government to be able to argue that and prove their theory of the case, that it was Airman Custis who initiated the conversation and asked it. It was his own statements that proved the government's case. So the evidence was material, and its quality was undeniable. Without this evidence, the government did not have a case on solicitation other than mere speculation.
You don't think that the members could have inferred from the fact that this was an action that would have only benefited him and not benefited her, and her description of her actions, they don't think that it would have been a reasonable inference for them to assume that he asked her to do it?
They could have made that inference, absolutely.
So why is there prejudice?
Because there would also be an equally compelling inference that she too had much to gain by accomplishing this blood swap. She was his spouse. She also was in the military. She stood a lot to lose if he got into trouble. This was her spouse, after all. Her esteem, income, and the like would also, in order to her prejudice, would he be found in trouble. She was the one who looked at the lab. She was the one who knew about all these procedures. So she did have an incentive as well for him to avoid possible sanction for the DUI and his drunken disorderly conduct.
What about the conspiracy specification?
Regarding the members' findings, the government probably does have a strong case in that regard. The circumstantial evidence would generally suggest the fact that a conversation took place, and in light of Emma Custis' wife's testimony regarding her actions, would suggest that they were at least talking together about committing a crime. So the conspiracy, we can see that the evidence it would be harmless in that regard regarding the members' findings.
Despite the fact that the military judge merged conspiracy and solicitation for sentencing?
Well, yes, Your Honor, because Aaron Custis still does have a conviction for solicitation. But that being said, the evidence did have an influence on sentence as well. The government offered a very brief 5.5-page sentencing argument. Therein, he made multiple references to these statements. He was able to make an argument that allowed the government to further its theory of the case that Aaron Custis was the ringleader. He was the bad guy in this, and that he was more culpable than his wife. On page 710, trial counsel specifically said that Aaron Custis solicited another airman to cover up his crime. On page 711, trial counsel again said that Aaron Custis deliberately involved another airman to cover up his crime. And on page 712, he made his point more clear when he said this was Aaron Custis' idea. He was the leader in the obstruction of justice. So this allowed trial counsel, without these statements, he couldn't have made such an argument, to press further and request a punitive discharge for offenses that might not, on their face, appear to be an obvious result for his offenses. So we would submit that also that the evidence did have a substantial influence on the sentence as well. But going back to findings, again, the government's burden here is to prove that it was harmless. They did not have a substantial influence on the members' findings on the solicitation charge.
We don't have sentence appropriateness powers, but are you suggesting that a punitive discharge wouldn't have been an appropriate punishment for this kind of skullduggery, absent the solicitation or assuming it emerged?
Well, certainly it is an authorized punishment. We suggest merely is that the evidence as it was admitted and how trial counsel was able to make use of it allowed trial counsel to urge it upon the members much more compellingly so as a result of the erroneous admission of the evidence. By reading the government's brief, it appears to suggest that they are arguing that the evidence is otherwise sufficient regarding at least the solicitation charge, but that's not the test. There is no other characterization of this evidence other than it had to have had a substantial influence on the members' findings. At the very least, there's a grave doubt that it did not. And in light of that, the error would be reversible.
Counsel, the government's other argument on page 16 and 17 of their brief is that this was not error, even if the rule doesn't have an exception, because under the rules, when someone discloses the substance of a conversation to a third party, that constitutes waiver of the privilege. So I'm not sure whether you addressed this in your brief or not, but could you address that now, the government's argument on page 16 and 17 of their brief?
Yes, Your Honor. The statement, "Star has my back," is the basis for the waiver argument that the government makes, as well as I believe the Air Force Court made it below. "Star has my back," at best, is a vague and ambiguous statement. It does not reveal a significant portion of the communication. And in fact, it doesn't even necessarily reveal that communication took place. That statement, "Star has my back," could very well mean the revealing of conduct. So we would submit that there is no waiver, there is no basis to find a waiver in this case, merely because, again, it's a vague and ambiguous statement that could very well mean that the wife came up with the idea, the wife initiated the entire conversation, the wife was the perpetrator of the offense, But alternatively, more importantly, it does not necessarily reveal a communication.
What's the basis for your argument that a conversation can't have more than one meaning if it's going to be considered a waiver of a privilege? That is, here the individual has made a statement susceptible, as you suggest, of more than one meaning. Why does that not constitute a waiver at that point if it has a meaning that does constitute revelation of the substance of the conversation?
Because that would assume that it actually revealed the substance of a conversation. Again, we would argue that it could very well have just revealed conduct. And if we look at the context in which that statement was made to the co-worker, Aaron Brown merely asked, what about the DUI? Aaron Custis said, yeah, it happened, but Star has my back. And when Aaron Brown was asked, did you ask him what that means, he said no. So there's no indication in the record that he even knew what Aaron Custis was referring to.
Or isn't that an indicator? Can't you equally say that he understood it precisely, and therefore he didn't need to ask a follow-up question?
Absolutely. That is one interpretation. But if we're going to look at...
You still haven't answered the Chief Judge's question. If it is susceptible of two interpretations, one of which arguably points to waiver, where does that leave you?
Have a moment, please.
Counsel, was there anything about the comment, Star has my back, or was there anything preceding that comment or following that comment that suggested that he was talking about a conversation he had with his wife?
No, Your Honor. The comment was made in response to Aaron Brown's question, essentially, are you worried about the DUI, what happened over the weekend? And Aaron Custis merely told Aaron Brown it happened, but it still has my back.
Well, I mean, is there anything that you're aware of in the case law that the mere fact that you say that your wife has your back, that constitutes a waiver of marital privilege?
No, Your Honor.
If you're not talking about a conversation that you had with your wife?
No, Your Honor. And I guess where the Chief Judge's question is that, well, that might be one interpretation, if I understand correctly, there's an equally possible interpretation that it could qualify as a waiver. And to be honest, I am unaware of any authority that says that there has to be a conclusive interpretation of what the statement means, whether or not it qualifies as a waiver. My only thought on the subject is that to qualify as a waiver, it has to reveal a significant portion of the communication. To assume that merely because it's capable of being interpreted as being a communication, to me suggests that it would have to be assumed at the outset that did in fact reveal a communication in the first place. I do know that there's authority that while a statement that may be cryptic does not necessarily reveal that a communication took place, or even if it did reveal that a communication took place, it still does not constitute a waiver. And the cases we rely on that would be, aside in our brief, although not for that proposition, would be McElhaney and McCall, where they would find a waiver in one portion in one case, but did not find a waiver in the other based on the context in which the statement was made. While Aaron Brown might have equally believed that he was talking about what Aaron Starr was going to do for him and what they talked about, there's nothing else in the record that suggests that Aaron Brown knew where Aaron Custis' wife worked or what she was capable of being able to do for him. So in light of that, I would suggest that the facts as they're presented in this record don't rise to the level of being at least sufficient to be able to find a waiver. But if there are no other questions, for the foregoing reasons, we would request that this court find error, set aside the solicitation finding, and order a sentence rehearing.
Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear counsel for the government.
My name is Major Donna Rappel, and I, along with Major Matthew Ward, represent the government in this matter. As the defense argued that the issue was whether or not the crime fraud exception applies, the government asserts that the issue is more narrowly construed and that the issue is whether or not the military judge abused his discretion at the time he made his ruling when he allowed spousal communications into evidence. And the government argues that he did not. Based upon the military judge's use of the current Air Force precedent at the time, additionally, applying the Military Rule of Evidence 510, the appellant waived the privilege by his disclosure to a third party. However, if this court
if the privilege applies, is it absolute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I guess I don't...
If the privilege applies, is it absolute? If in the government's view there's no question that it's a maritally privileged conversation, you were to say, then the game's over, right? In terms of its admission in court?
Well, no, Your Honor, there are enumerated exceptions.
No, right, but there's no exception.
No exception to the exceptions?
Right.
No, Your Honor.
What I'm trying to get at is the judge seems to have applied a balancing test. Is that what applies? You said the judge didn't abuse his discretion,
right.
And so I'm testing whether he might have abused his discretion.
Well, at the time,
I've decided in trying to balance the interest of the marital communication privilege with the interest of justice. Is that the test to decide whether an exception applies?
Based on the current case law, the government would say no. However, based on the case law at the time that the military judge was making his ruling, he was reading the Air Force Court decision in United States versus Smith. And this court had affirmed Smith on other grounds, obviously applying waiver versus addressing the question of whether or not 501A4 can be applied like the military judge applied it in this case. However, based on the fact that at the time the military judge was making his ruling, he was relying on the current Air Force Court precedent at the time, and this court had remained silent on the issue of whether or not 501A4 would allow for a crime fraud exception. So that being the case, in looking at the analysis that he had before him of the rules, including 501A4 and 504, he properly applied the current case law at the time, which was the Air Force's decision in United States versus Smith, where they applied a somewhat balancing test.
So the government's argument is that we should grant review in every case in which the Court of Criminal Appeals makes a statement as to the proposition of law, because if we don't grant review of that case, then we're then bound by the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals because the judge will then apply the service court ruling?
That is not what the government is trying to convey. However,
well, that sounded like your, that's what your answer sounded like to Judge Baker, that is, the judge didn't err because he applied the current Air Force rule and we didn't grant, we didn't act on the full decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals, so we're bound by that ruling because the judge applied the ruling of the Court of Criminal Appeals.
Well, Your Honor, let me put it a different way then. The military judge applied, when looking at the military rules of evidence, the military judge clearly questioned how 501A4 could be used or if it could be used in a manner in which to allow the crime fraud exception to 504, despite the fact that it was not enumerated in the manual. When he looked at the Air Force Court precedent of United States versus Smith, that court held that under 501A4, you could apply the crime fraud exception despite the fact that it wasn't enumerated, following the Army case that was later overruled. However, at that point in time, this court had not yet come out with any discussion or holding regarding whether or not the crime fraud exception applied. Not saying that this court is then bound by the Air Force Court's conclusion in the military judge's actions thereof, simply stating that the standard of review at this point in time is whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, not a question of whether or not that law is correct or it should be applied now or upheld now. It's a question of, did he abuse his discretion, which is a different standard of review.
But counsel, doesn't that have a two-part, doesn't the question whether he abused his discretion have two parts to it? One, whether he applied the law correctly, and don't we get to review that de novo?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if in our view he applied the law incorrectly, irrespective of the fact that he thought it was correct based on Air Force precedent, can't we say he failed that prong?
Well, the government's argument would be that a test of a military judge's discretion is based on the law at the time, and I understand what Your Honor is saying in the fact of how did he, if he improperly applied the military rules of evidence as they existed. The government's argument would be, how can a military judge abuse his discretion when he is applying the law as interpreted by the higher courts that he must follow? So in this particular case, he went and sought guidance from the higher court, the Air Force Court, and the Air Force Court had applied the crime fraud exception at that time. So, in other words, to say that when a military judge has a question on how to apply a rule contained in the manual and he looks at the precedent that is currently existing and determines to not go with that but instead construe stricter meaning, is that then the only way that he cannot be abusing his discretion? Because otherwise, how is a military judge supposed to know what is going to be determined at a later date? He can only go by how the rules are being interpreted at the date he needs to make his ruling.
So are you suggesting that if we hold that there is no such exception, we should nonetheless let this pass because he, even though he erred, he didn't abuse his discretion? We should affirm? That's what you seem to be saying.
Right, Your Honor. And the government's argument would be, yes, you should affirm in this case.
Well, no, that's not what I'm asking. I obviously want us to affirm. But if we find that this exception doesn't exist in the present MRE, are you suggesting that nonetheless we should simply say, oh, but he didn't abuse his discretion because the only thing he had to hang his hat on was the Air Force Court, and we should just let it pass in this case?
Because that seems to kind of go back to the Chief Judge's suggestion that we would then be effectively bound in some sort of convoluted fashion, at least, by a ruling of a lower court on an issue of law that four members of the court declined to pass on and one member of the court wrote quite extensively on.
Yes, Your Honors. I understand sort of the situation as far as what that puts this court in. However, the government would argue that this particular case, there are other reasons why this court should affirm, certainly, not only based on whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, but you could find, certainly, that the crime fraud exception doesn't apply and still be able to affirm this case based on both the application of waiver as well as harmless error analysis.
Had he said that to me, as a fellow airman, I wouldn't have had the foggiest idea what he was talking about. But let us assume that his fellow airman had some notion that his wife was going to take care of it. Is that enough to constitute waiver of the, importation of the substance of the conversation to a third party, or is that standard?
The government's position is that that conversation is enough. It relayed a significant portion of the conversation in the sense of this was a friend, later an acquaintance, but a person that he knew. And when talking about his DUI arrest, he stated that he wasn't worried because his wife had his back. Now, based on the record, there certainly is no direct information of whether or not he actually knew what the wife did for her work. However, based on the fact that he was a friend, you would assume that he would know that the wife worked as a lab technician.
Because the fact that he would know a fact that was embedded in the conversation, how does that waive anything about the conversation itself?
The standard isn't that he needed to know a fact about the conversation.
Right, but that's what you're talking about, is facts that he might have known or not known that have something to do with what he told the other airmen, but they have nothing to do with the communication that he had with his wife.
Well, Your Honor, I guess in part I would disagree, only because that his statement that Starr has my back in talking about why he was not worried about his DUI arrest, if you take in that context that the coworker knew his wife was a lab technician that works at the lab. I mean, clearly, then, when you have Starr has my back, and he knew that he was arrested for DUI, that he was tested for DUI, and his wife is a lab technician, that implies that they have had a communication, which also would imply that some sort of action was going to be taken on part by the wife that would somehow relieve him of this conviction or the situation in which he was in. And this court in United States versus McElhaney in 2000 found waiver when there was simple innuendo in a letter regarding their relationship, and statements like the cat's out of the bag and other innuendo about the relationship. But this court found that the intent was for that individual to understand the overall substance of the conversation, and therefore applied waiver in that case.
If you've been talking about his attorney, then you'd say also waiver of the attorney-client privilege. I'm not worried. My lawyer's got my back.
Well,
oh, sorry. Go ahead. Bring in all the attorney-client material.
No, Your Honor, that is not the government's argument on that point, simply because, I mean, an attorney's job is to...
Well, what's the privilege if merely saying... My wife's got my back. That waives all conversations with the wife, though, but not with the attorney.
Well,
there's no inconsistency between your position.
Yes, I would believe that is not inconsistent, because an attorney's job is to help their client. So a statement such as, my attorney's got my back, I would hope your attorney has...
A spouse's job is to preserve the marital relationship according to the marital privilege.
However, the conversation was in the context of, I hear you got arrested for a DUI. Yes, I did, but I'm not worried because...
Isn't that the exact same context in which someone's going to say to someone else, hey, my lawyer's going to take care of it?
Yes, Your Honor. However, for waiver to apply, there does not have to be a single meaning of a conversation. There doesn't have to be the disclosure of specific facts that were discussed in the conversation. There simply needs to be innuendo, as this court found in McElhaney.
And doesn't there at least have to be an innuendo that there was a conversation? I mean, there's nothing about wife's got my back that means that they've had a communication at all. It could have been a hopeful wife's got my back. It could have been many, many things. But it doesn't suggest by its terms, it doesn't imply in any sort of concrete way, in the same way the cat's out of the bag, that there was a conversation at all.
Well, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. The government's position is that it can be used to imply that they've had a conversation and that they have reached some sort of agreement, whereas the wife is going to now take action that will benefit him in some way. And so the government's position is that is enough to apply waiver, and that's based upon McElhaney as well as other applications of waiver in this court's history. However, even if this court does not find waiver...
Before we leave waiver, in McElhaney, did the military judge make a ruling on waiver that was being reviewed by this court, or did this court find waiver based on the record? We can pass on that now. My question, follow-up question, would be, assuming that the military judge in this case did not rule on waiver, and I believe that's, in this case, the military judge ruled on waiver in this case?
It doesn't appear.
Right. So we have, what posture should we review that in when we have ambiguities, as opposed to a case in which the military judge, having heard the witnesses, and considered all the evidence, resolves an ambiguity or states on the record how that ambiguity should be considered?
Well, the history of looking at spousal privilege has been to construe the privilege broadly and the exceptions narrowly. So in that event, this court would likely look at the waiver issue with a narrow frame of reference. However, if this court were to find that waiver does not apply and that the military judge did abuse his discretion, then the government would argue that harmless error applies in this case. And the reason that the government argues that is if you look at the facts as admitted at trial, taking out the conversations that you had between the appellant and his spouse, you still have significant evidence for which to find that the members could have reasonably found appellant guilty of all three offenses, conspiracy, solicitation, as well as obstruction of justice. You have the fact that the wife could have still testified about her observations of him the night that he came into the clinic. When she drew his blood, she stated that she observed him intoxicated, appearing intoxicated, and smelling of alcohol, that his eyes were bloodshot. She also stated that they did, when she went home, that the appellant came home later and that they had a conversation that made her feel uncomfortable. The next day, she brought home the necessary medical supplies to draw his blood. She drew the appellant's blood, which he fully cooperated with. Then she took the new sample back to work the next day and exchanged it for the original sample, which she brought home and gave to the appellant and never saw again. Those actions in and of itself show that there was a conspiracy between the two to obstruct justice in the sense of swapping out the two blood samples. Based on the fact that she went and got the necessary equipment to redraw his blood, did so, and then swapped it out with the original sample, gave it to the appellant, which he accepted it, and then he destroyed, implying he destroyed it. There's no verbal agreement needed for the conspiracy, so you wouldn't need any conversations, evidence of any conversations. Simply the actions that she took are enough to demonstrate conspiracy. As far as the obstruction of justice is clear by the fact that he allowed his blood to be drawn and then took possession of the original sample, knowing it was such, and did away with it.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, if you don't mind. It sounds to me that all of the things that you're listing here would definitely tip the balance if the question before us was whether or not, absent the wife's testimony about their privileged communications, there was still sufficient evidence upon which to affirm his conviction. That's not the question that we have, though, is it? Isn't the question whether or not the evidence that was admitted, if it was improperly admitted, had a substantial influence on the members?
That's correct, Your Honor. However, in this case, the government would argue that the conversations that she actually testified to were limited in the sense of she did say that he asked her about whether she was the only one working that night, what the procedures were as far as and she was somewhat vague about this, what the procedures were as far as the legal DUI tests and whether or not she had access to Lockbox. And she did testify that he asked me if they could fix it. So as the appellant argues, clearly, really the issue spins on the solicitation charge. Because based on the other sort of vague references to the conversation that they had, the government's position is that it didn't significantly impact the findings in this case, and when you looked at the other evidence in total. But when you look at the solicitation charge, she did testify that he asked her those questions and that he initiated the conversation. However,
don't you think it would be hard for this court to be able to say that a wife's testimony that her husband asked her to do something didn't have a significant impact on the member's decision to find him guilty of solicitation?
Well, certainly, certainly it was a factor. Whether or not it was significant is really the question. before the court, the government would argue, given all the facts in this case and the evidence presented, that it was not, quote-unquote, significant, in that you can also, if you take out that one comment that he asked me and looked at the remaining evidence presented, certainly it can be inferred that there was a solicitation there based on the fact that he was the one in trouble and that he was the one that had everything to gain by her fixing it. Now, with that being said, both the conspiracy and the solicitation charges were merged for sentencing purposes. And when you look at the sentence landscape in this case, clearly, even if you took out the solicitation charge, you were not going to have a change in the sentencing landscape in this case, as the appellant only received a bad conduct discharge and 30 days confinement and a reduction to E1. So given the charges that he was actually found guilty of, the sentence that was actually imposed was arguably not going to be affected by the solicitation charge in and of itself. But when you have the conspiracy and the obstruction of justice and the DUI and the disorderly, those are what made up the bulk of the actual sentence adjudged in this case.
Just to follow up on that solicitation then, what in the record, putting aside the conversation, would give us confidence that the conversation didn't have a substantial effect from the perspective that was discussed earlier, and that it may, in a situation like this, may well be that the spouse would initiate protective action for the person who's in trouble?
Although, in this particular case, I'll address the first part of your question and then I'll say what it is. Regarding what other evidence is in the record that would support the solicitation, as I stated, the wife could testify to the fact that when she came home, they had a conversation. And then she went to work the next day and got the materials and did what she did. So the fact that they had a conversation could certainly be evidence, circumstantial evidence of solicitation.
That would be in a legal sufficiency context, but in context of substantial influence, why isn't that evidence that's put forward well consistent with the idea that the spouse initiated the conversation to protect the husband?
Well, in this particular case, Your Honor, the spouse was also military, and so by the spouse initiating the conversation to cover this up for him by basically committing crimes herself doesn't make necessarily the most sense in this situation, because she has a husband that has already previously received an Article 15 for DUI. This is obviously his second incident. And you have an individual that, as her job, is to take these samples when they're presented to the lab. So for her to essentially take her job and lay her job on the line and commit crimes and violate the law simply to cover up what appears to be a repeated course of conduct by her husband doesn't necessarily make sense as the best alternative.
Well, counsel, if the test were whether the action of spouses made a great deal of sense and logic in the way they handled relationships between each other when one's accused of a crime, many of the cases that we've had before this court would have a very different testimony than what we've seen.
Yes, Your Honor. However, as much as there is an inference that maybe she did take it upon herself and swap out the samples, it is also a reasonable inference that given the evidence, without that testimony, the members could have found him guilty of solicitation.
But that's not the test that we're looking at here, right? That's whether the evidence was sufficient absent the marital communications.
Well, it intertwines in a way with the significant factor, because whatever is a significant factor, if you took away a significant factor, then you're saying that the members could no longer have reasonably found a person guilty of that offense. And what the government is arguing is that it is not a significant factor, because if you took it away, the members could still reasonably find he was guilty of that offense. So the two are somewhat intertwined. The government obviously relying on the fact that it wasn't a significant factor, and it is reasonable for the members to still find him guilty of solicitation.
Counsel, my understanding of Jackson against Virginia, the way this court's applied it, is that significant factor is not the test for legal sufficiency.
Not for legal sufficiency.
Right.
For the...
Right, so that if this evidence may well have been legally sufficient to convict him for solicitation, but the question is whether this had a significant factor upon the effect on the members in deciding whether to convict him of this particular offense.
Right, Your Honor.
And I thought you had said if you take this away, they couldn't convict him.
No, Your Honor, that is not what I said. I meant to say, and maybe I didn't say it clearly enough, that it is not a significant factor because if you took it away, the members could still find that he was guilty of solicitation based on the evidence that the members would have heard absent the comment that he asked me. It's still there, circumstantial evidence. The members could have found him guilty of solicitation.
That sounds like you're making a legal sufficiency argument. I may be mistaken. They could have found him guilty is they could have found legally sufficient evidence. I don't understand that to be the test with respect, as Judge Ryan has suggested, with respect to the prejudice from erroneously admitted evidence on a privilege.
Right, and what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, is that the two factors, the two tests, significant factor and the fact that the government is sort of merging the two, and obviously I'm not doing it well and I'm confusing the court, so I'll stop, but the significant factor, the government's argument is that it is not a significant factor. Clearly it's a factor, clearly it's the evidence that, so to speak, may have put the nail in the coffin. However, it was not the only evidence. Members can make inferences. It was not, quote unquote, substantial in this case. So, if there are no further questions, I'll...
I have a further question. Let's go back to first principles. How do you answer the defense's expressio unius argument? If the president went to the trouble of importing specific exceptions to this specific privilege and that specific rule, what's your basis for trying to pull this in from some other source?
Well,
pull this exception in from some other source when the president did not see fit to include it.
The government's argument would basically spin off of MRE 102 that basically provides that the rule should be construed to secure fairness in administration and that the truth may be ascertained and proceedings.
Well, that's a statement of you know, that's a statement, you know, covering the whole ball of rules. The fact remains that the president saw fit to include certain specific exceptions. And under the canons of statutory construction, how do you get where you need to get?
Well, the president also found to put in 501A4, which talks about looking at common law as long as it does not contradict with the manual.
Counsel, I don't see that in 501A4. So I read 501A4, it says that privileges not otherwise provided for can be found.
Yes,
where in 501A4 does it say that where you have an express privilege in the rule, an exception can be found in the common law?
It does not specifically state that in the rule.
Thank you.
Counsel, could you address, and this it relates to the Chief Judge's recent question, United States versus Tipton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't United States versus Tipton suggest that we not do exactly what you're asking us to do?
Yes, Your Honor. However, when you look at this court's decision in United States versus Taylor, you see some sort of, for lack of a better term, massaging of facts to fit them into exceptions that are codified in the rule that have been taken out of the manual previously by the president and were not reinserted into the manual. So it gives the impression that there is some flexibility as far as applying common law to the manual under certain provisions. So the government's argument is that 501A4 not only encompasses the application of a privilege found under common law, but also the exceptions to privilege found under common law is a broader reading of 501A4.
But I don't think anything in Taylor suggested that it was grounded in an exception found at common law. I think that it was based in its understanding of what the drafters of the rule intended the words to mean.
That's what the majority opinion was, yes, Your Honor. However, when you look at the analysis under the history of the manual, you see that adultery was originally included in that exception in 1969 and was taken out. And it was never put back in. So as a strict reading of the manual, you could infer that adultery was not intended by the president to be included as an exception under the spousal.
But Taylor was a case dealing with the reach of an explicit exception.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now you're trying to import an exception that's not laid out at all.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't see how Taylor gets you very far.
Yes, Your Honor. There isn't much that this court has decided that gets me very far in this situation. However, I will just briefly say that the government's position on that crime fraud application is a broader reading of 501A4. Otherwise, I will briefly conclude. The Air Force Court applied the proper standard in this case and found the military judge did not abuse his discretion. The appellant had waived any privilege by disclosure to a third party, and the military judge applied the current case precedent at the time of his ruling. If, however, this court finds that not to be the case, then the government would argue that it was, in fact, harmless error. Accordingly, the government asked this court to affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes. McElhaney is distinguishable from this case, the reason being the context in which the court looked at whether that waiver applied. The third party to whom the disclosure was made was somebody who was privy to the secret of which the accused actually disclosed to the spouse. So in that case, although it was a cryptic reference, this court did look at the fact that the third party to whom it was disclosed actually knew what the accused probably was talking about. In this case, we don't have sufficient information to even indicate that. When we're looking at waiver of privilege, what we're trying to do is trying to figure out, did the accused or the spouse reveal a significant portion of the communication? The military judge clearly didn't make any ruling on that in this case. He was presented with evidence that might have suggested it to him, but we presume that he knows the law, didn't take any action on it. And so for that matter, for that reason, there shouldn't be a reason to question the different interpretations. The interpretation by the military judge in this case appears to be it didn't amount to waiver.
Counsel, assuming that we agree with your argument, why would we need to send it back for sentence rehearing when the military judge merged the conspiracy and the solicitation specifications for sentencing?
Because the statements that form the basis of the solicitation conviction form a central part of the trial counsel's argument, the main thrust of his argument regarding the conspiracy and obstruction of justice charges. It was the statements that led to the communications that led to the conviction of solicitation, but also allowed trial counsel to make Airman Custis the more culpable party in the conspiracy and the obstruction of justice. So it did play into his sentencing argument as well.
But I think what Judge Urban is asking is, since I understand your argument about what use was made of the statements for the obstruction and the conspiracy, if they merged solicitation with one of those offenses for sentencing purposes, why does it need to be sent back? I mean, the military judge said these two are as one for purposes of sentencing. So even if one goes away, how does it change the outcome?
Because there's still erroneous submission of evidence that formed a part of the trial counsel's argument that would not have otherwise been there.
But that's not the standard, is it? The standard is whether it had an effect on the members.
Right. So,
and if the judge said, members, you treat these as one for purposes of sentencing, how could it have had an effect?
Because the instruction would go towards just consider the charges as one.
Well, your argument makes sense as to findings, certainly. But we have to assume that the members do what they're told by the military judge. And he said these are the same for sentencing. There is no difference. Even if we were to accept your earlier arguments that the solicitation is gone, it's hard to find why we should send it back.
And
what we're just trying to stress is that the evidence that underlie the offenses, the evidence that supported the government's arguments for conviction, were used and did have a substantial influence on the members.
For findings, but then we would have to assume that the members ignored the judge's instruction on sentencing in order for you to prevail on that argument.
I guess what I'm trying to, my understanding of it is the use of the evidence was not only used at findings, but the evidence was also used at sentencing. And even though the charges were merged for sentencing purposes, the evidence still was argued to the members in a way that allowed trial counsel to request a punishment and receive a punishment that might not otherwise he would have received.
Counsel, could you address briefly a response to the government's argument about the review here for abuse of discretion with respect to the lower court relying on precedent set forth by the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I was going to get to that one. The military judge in this case obviously was probably bound by stare decisis as a result of the Air Force Court's decision in Smith. However, this court does review his conclusions of law and its abuse of discretion review de novo, and an erroneous application of law is a basis to find an abuse of discretion. For that reason, this court can look at the military judge's conclusions of law and find that he did err, despite the fact of what happened with United States versus Smith. So if there are any further questions, we again do request that the court find error, set aside the solicitation of charge, and order sentence review.
Thank you, counsel. Thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. Case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess until 10 a.m.
The court stands in recess for 5 minutes.
Hey, Dave, can you call Adam? Oh, there's...